The sweetest thing in all my life has been the longing to reach the mountain, to find the place where all the beauty comes from, my country, a place where I ought to have been born. This is the second lecture in Wyoming Catholic College's distance learning course, Into the Lenten Desert, Learning to Pray with the Medieval Masters, with Dr. Jason Baxter. I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkwich. The lines I quoted are from C.S. Lewis's novel, Till We Have Faces. The scene is between two sisters, Orwell and Psyche, the speaker. Set in the ancient world, Psyche has been chosen to be a human sacrifice to the god of the sacred mountain, where she will be tied up until the god, or possibly the beast, Orwell's fear, takes her. Psyche, with a mystical frame of mind, looks forward to the encounter with the god. Orwell, who has imbibed a rationalistic form of Greek philosophy, doesn't understand at all, and in a sense, thinks her sister quite mad. Mystics have, perhaps, always been a bit misunderstood, but never so much as in the rationalistic, technological, materialistic era in which we live. Ours is a disenchanted cosmos, where the mystic's cosmos is most enchanted. In this session, Dr. Baxter asks, how did we get here? Why we need the medieval masters?
In the previous lecture, I gave a general introduction to some of the themes and ideas of this course into the Lenten Desert. In this lecture, I'd like to take up the question, why do we need the medieval masters in particular? Why in this age of skyscrapers, and computers, and electricity, are the fragmented writings of men and women from a distant age, whose habits of mind were so foreign to our own, all of a sudden strike us as possessing a wisdom which we need desperately? Religion has not disappeared from the modern world, of course, but even the religious person's quest for God in our day unfolds within what the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor calls the imminent frame. By that term, he means that the social and psychological conditions have dramatically changed from roughly 1500 to 2000 AD. He says, the presence of something beyond what we call today the natural is more palpable and immediate, one might say physical, in an enchanted age. The sacred in the strong sense, which marks out certain people, times, place, and actions, in distinction to all others as profane, is by its very nature localizable, and its place is clearly marked out in ritual and sacred geography. This is what we sense and often regret the passing of when we contemplate the medieval cathedral. God-forsakenness is an experience of those whose ancestral culture has been transformed and repressed by a relentless process of disenchantment, whose deprivations can still be keenly felt. But it has been part of a move from one religious life to another long before it came to be, mistakenly, seen by some as a facet of the decline of religion altogether. In other words, this long process of secularization has involved, as Charles Taylor has related in painstaking detail, a multitude of cultural forces. But the result is that religion is less obvious than it used to be. Taylor again. One way to put the question is this. Why was it virtually impossible not to believe in God in, say, 1500 AD in our Western society? While in 2000, many of us find that this is not only easy, but even inescapable. I'll have occasion to talk about this more in the next lecture, but the result of this long-term fermentation process of secularization is that in our age, we live under the conditions of what another scholar, Louis Dupré, has called practical atheism, or A-theism. According to Dupré's own masterful account, the guarded, hesitant atheism of a few members of the cultural elite, say in the 18th century, became the strident, apologetical atheism of the 19th century, which in turn yielded to a benign atheism that shaped the cultural landscape of everyday life by the beginning of the 20th century. Part of the story of the rise of such everyday atheism, in which the felt presence of the divine receded from my daily life as a modern, is accounted for by the collapse of the bulwarks of belief, that is, beliefs, which, though not specifically theological, created a favorable environment for belief. When everyone believed in an enchanted cosmos, when the hair on your neck stands up on end when you leave the boundaries of your parish, when you really worry about how impish fairies might wish to enchant your children, when your court physician, Marsilio Ficino, is an expert in preparing amulets, which you can wear over your heart to help you imbibe the power of astral bodies, then religion does not just make sense, but the alternative is almost unthinkable. This is the porous world of pre-modernity, whose heroes are Achilles, who was hardly surprised to find gods descending to speak to him, or Roland, who cannot destroy his sword when striking it against a rock, because it has relics embedded within it. It's a world in which you cannot escape God, but like John Bunyan, you feel his watchful eye even when you choose to live in a way which is displeasing to him. In contrast to such enchanted views of the cosmos, or even to the philosophical visions of Plato's Timaeus or Boethius' Consolation, who describe the cosmos as having a soul which moves, groaning to express something about God, the shapers of the scientific revolution, whose vision shaped our intellectual world, assiduously avoided making any assumptions about the external ends of nature. Nature must be treated as a brute creature, approached as a great mechanism, they said. It is true that the great scientists of the 17th century, they would have preferred to call themselves natural philosophers, believed in God and angels and invisible realities. Copernicus, Kepler, and Newton were deeply pious, thinking of themselves as priests of nature. Boyle left money in his will to combat atheism, and there were good Catholics like the Jesuit Massin. And yet, as it turns out, this habit of approaching the natural world as merely a mechanism, some call it methodological naturalism, became over the slow course of the next centuries adopted as a philosophical paradigm. What has been a methodological exclusion of external causes became eventually an assumption that such external causes were merely religious and thus superfluous for explaining what's really important. Again, none of this means that in our secular age, religion has disappeared, but rather it's typically confined to the interior and subjective sphere. Charles Taylor says that whereas we once had a feeling for the depth of being out there in the universe, we now have transferred that sense onto the interior. In his own words, we conceive of ourselves as having inner depths. We might even say that the depths which were previously located in the cosmos, the enchanted world, are now more readily placed within. And this transfer from the cosmos to the interior is on display everywhere, from how we live to how we build. For example, look at an aerial view of Durham Cathedral. The town is a harmonious blend of sacred architecture, streets of houses and businesses which orbit around the church, and natural surroundings harmoniously integrated. Heidelberg, Germany, and York, England, and towns in Umbria and Tuscany present similar cases. But while many European cities resemble the old cosmos, with buildings literally radiating out and orbiting around their religious centers, modern cities betray their anti-cosmic individualism. If you drive through Dallas, for example, a city you really like, by the way, that modern city par excellence, then you will find not a cosmos, but a collection of individually wrought buildings competing for your attention. In summary, we can borrow Taylor's term to describe the movement from the enchanted world to the disenchanted world, excarnation. Quote, official Christianity has gone through what we can call an excarnation, transfer out of an embodied, enfleshed form of religious life to those which are more in the head, end quote. The result is that the sacred is felt to have withdrawn from the public sphere, and indeed from the physical, visible world, so that our ordinary actions can be carried out seemingly without any connection to the sacred. And perhaps as importantly, it means also that our picture of God has changed, how we imagine him, what we feel we need him for. For this reason, Louis Dupré argued that Western nihilism actually began in a religious age, the age in which God was asked to fit into this picture of the world. Quote, even without committing ourselves to Heidegger's distinction between being and beings, we cannot but agree with him that the reduction of the ground of all reality to the sum of separate beings excludes ultimate transcendence. This is exactly what occurs when we refer to God as the supreme value, or as the cause of all beings. This abolition of true transcendence is the true atheism of our culture, one which has been developing for centuries before it became manifest, and which consists not in the loss of the actual belief of God, but in the loss of the very possibility of that belief. In this respect, believers, even more than unbelievers, have failed their God, or in Nietzsche's terms, murdered him, by lowering him to a scale of being where he can no longer be truly sacred. Thus, the concept of God as the supreme value, inclusive of all others, inevitably leads to atheistic rebellion. End quote. In other words, in a world in which materialistic explanations seem sufficient, we often invite God back into the picture, but in a way which he is imprisoned within it. If he is invited back, he's expected to hide behind the natural world as its cause or supreme value. In this way, God gets objectified and reified, that is, reduced to a thing of the cosmos. Dupree continues, criticizing this thinking of God as the highest value or supreme being. Quote, "For the longest period of its existence, our culture remained close to its transcendent source. Only with the advent of the modern era did a fundamental change take place. It appears that such philosophical expressions as author of nature, by which Descartes and his followers refer to God as a particular piece in the intricate machinery of nature, necessary only because of the need of a cause in a mechanistic universe. Everything of real interest came after the first cause. This would soon enough lead to the bloodless deism of the 17th century, and eventually to the consistent atheistic materialism of the 18th and 19th centuries." End quote. Changes in our cosmic imaginary and metaphysics also have implications in how we think about devotion and morality. In the modern world, God's chief interactions with human beings is to provide a kind of spiritual uplift, a kind of rising tide of morality, an inspiration to be honest, just, disciplined, hardworking, and so on. The scholar Murray Rost contrasts the intensity of belief, the personal fervor, and the conviction, the almost desperate condition of divines like Lancelot Andrews and John Donne, with the calmly reasoned advocacy of Christianity as the promoter of order and virtuous conduct among rational believers, as found in the sermons at the end of the 17th century. Contrast, for example, John Donne's plaintive cry, "Forgive me my crying sins and my whispering sins, sins of uncharitable hate and sins of unchaste love, sins against thee," with Cambridge theologian and mathematician, teacher of Isaac Newton, Isaac Barrow, who says this, "Christianity is a most rational act, arguing the person to be sagacious, considerate, and judicious. One who doth carefully inquire into things doth seriously weigh the case, doth judge soundly about it." End quote. Another divine from the same period, John Tillotson, likewise emphasized a Christianity free from hysterics. Quote, "Let us always be calm and considerate, and have the patience to examine things thoroughly and impartially. Let us be humble and willing to learn. Let us from ourselves, from prejudice and passion, from self-conceit and self-interest, which are often too strong a bias upon the judgment of the best men." The appeal of such a toned-down approach to religion makes sense after several violent centuries of religious divisiveness. And from such a perspective, visions, strong emotions, voices from God, personal commissions were dangerous. It's impossible to regulate such claims if they all claim to be particular revelations. And I hardly need to point out that wars, conquests, migrations, and schisms have all been the fruits of such abuses of religion. And so, in a world in which to be an enthusiast or a zealot was considered dangerously unregulated, for example, for David Hume, we can understand the appeal of a kind of piety that limited itself to advancing civic virtues, personal ethics, self-discipline, and tolerance. And it could easily become the case in which, culturally, the main purpose of religion could become to promote his virtues. God becomes a great instrument to supply inspiration and lend a helping hand. This, of course, is the norm now, as sociologists and journalists have pointed out. What was a new voice of moderation among the cultural elite around the turn of the 18th century has now become the unquestioned background music of our religious lives. We've now reached something of a saturation point of this practical atheism, or atheism. As was shown in the landmark sociological work of Christian Smith and Melinda Lundquist, published in 2005 as Soul Searching. Having gathered data from 3,000 interviews of North American teenagers, they concluded that the religious conviction of modern teenagers and the parents who teach them can be summed up as moralistic therapeutic deism. That is, a system of tacit beliefs according to which there is a God who exists, who created the world and defined our general moral order, but not one who is particularly personally involved in one's affairs, especially affairs in which one would prefer not to have God involved. Most of the time, the God of this faith keeps a safe distance. He's often described by teenagers as watching over everything from above, and the creator of everything, and just up there now controlling everything. For many teenagers, as with adults, God sometimes gets involved in people's lives, but usually only when they call on him, and mostly when they have some trouble or a problem or bad feeling that they want resolved. In this sense, the deism here is revised from its classical 18th century version by the therapeutic qualifier, making the distant God selectively available for taking care of needs. This God is not demanding. He actually can't be, because his job is to solve our problems and make people feel good. The title to the chapter whence I have borrowed these ideas is called God, Religion, Whatever. Other sociologists and teachers have been able to confirm anecdotally Smith and Denton's landmark work. Kendra Dean, for example, argued that the problem is not that American teenagers are getting the wrong ideas about religion. On the contrary, they're correctly absorbing what we actually believe. She calls our religious view of God, quote, the triumph of the cult of nice. Catholic theologian Ulrich Lehner has also commented on the religious horizons of his students. He says, quote, we've made attending church and believing in God something that nice and polite people do, mostly on Sundays. Quote. In the introduction to his book, God is Not Nice, Niebuhr is cited. In America, he says, we have a God without wrath, who brought man without sin into a kingdom without judgment through the ministrations of Christ without a cross. I do have had similar moments in teaching. When I talk about moralistic therapeutic deism with my students, they're always anxious because many of them seem to recognize their own tacit belief system, but they can't envision an alternative to a nice God in a religion of being polite. Thus, by the beginning of the 20th century, God, even if not completely dead, was at least no longer indubitably obvious. The fermentation process of secularization had already been at work for several hundred years. What Louis Dupré called a benign atheism had set in. Today's atheism, by and large, considers its position sufficiently secure to feel no need for defining itself through a negative relation to faith, he says. And so, for the first time in human history, it was possible to spend your whole life not just without encountering God, but without knowing you were supposed to. This course is about the alternative. This is not a course about natural theology, an attempt to argue from the structure of the world to the existence of God, nor is it a genealogy of modernity, that is, a history of the scientific revolution of modernity, or a psychology of religion. Rather, I'm interested in giving some idea of the shocking wildness of pre-modern conceptions of God, prayer, and the spiritual life. What follows, then, is a series of core samples in the mystical tradition. I'm going to act like a photographer just hanging up his favorite shots in an exhibition to provide a series of individual related moments, but as yet, not completely reconciled. I prefer to do this as opposed to providing my own streamlined theory of mysticism for many reasons. In part, because I don't really have one. In part, because I think surveying a select variety of mystical treatises and some detail will keep us from reaching for too easy formulas. When we keep in mind the slight discordances between Gregory of Nyssa's idea of eternal progress, and Dionysius' God beyond being, and Augustine's teaching on how the intellect melts into love, and Merton's bleak desert, then I think we're forced to remember that to a certain extent, all of these systems and teachings are themselves metaphorical. Nothing kills the mystique of mysticism quite like reductive systems. In short, I'm convinced that the reason mysticism seems so foreign to us has more to do with the fact that we live in a secular world, that is, an age in which our fundamental blueprint for thinking about the physical world, our humanity, and our relationship to God has changed. We might be the weird ones. In the next lecture, I'll start with the pagan inheritance, looking at the role of prayer and piety in the pre-Christian world.
Psyche continues with the passage I quoted earlier in my introduction. "Do you think it all means nothing, all this longing?" she asks. "The longing for home, for indeed it now feels not like going, but like going back. All my life, the God of the mountain has been wooing me." And all our lives, the God of heaven and earth has been wooing each one of us, wooing us to come home. We feel the inner longing, even in the disenchanted cosmos of modernity. And we're not alone. That longing has been shared by all people from all times. Join Dr. Baxter next week as he discusses Pagan's Grope Toward God, Piety and Prayer in Classical Antiquity. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.